I'm Leonard Lopate. This is WNYC 93.9 AM 820. We're online at WNYC.org. Today's underreported segment takes us to the Amazon basin, where oil exploration has boosted the economies of many of the countries in the region. But it's come at a cost, and one scientific journal has described the result as nothing short of a public health emergency. It's also threatening the culture and livelihood of the region's indigenous populations. Joining me now to talk about the matter are Atossa Soltani, the founder and executive director of Amazon Watch, and Kevin Koenig, who is the Northern Amazon Program Coordinator for Amazon Watch. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having us.
So how much oil is there in the Amazon?
Well, it's difficult to say how much oil there is, but what we can say is that when they do discover oil reserves in the Amazon, at most they last 15 to 20 years.
So it doesn't compare with the kinds of reserves we see in the Middle East?
Not at all. However, what one can say that in the United States, there's a growing amount of oil coming from Latin America. In fact, we are now importing more oil from Latin America than we do from the Middle East.
Although we've pretty much dried up Venezuela's reserves, haven't we?
Yes, well, most of that comes from Venezuela and now growing amount coming from Colombia. And however, it is important to note that, for example, Amazon oil crude from Ecuador finds itself in the U.S. market, and actually we are the number one market for Amazon crude from Ecuador.
So is Ecuador the country with the most oil, as far as we know?
I mean, Latin America is in a discovery mode, and that's kind of what we're concerned about, the growing interest in Latin America for oil. As I said, Venezuela and Colombia are the largest, but after that you have Ecuador, Peru are the new sort of sources of oil.
And it's mostly in the Amazon? This is an ecologically vulnerable area to begin with, isn't it?
It's right. It's sort of where the Amazon, where the Andes mountain range meets the Amazon. It's sort of where the oil has been discovered. And I think that this area is categorized as some of the most highly biodiverse places on Earth. You have, in the Amazon basin, one-third of all species on Earth, one-fifth of all the fresh water on the planet. And, in these areas in particular, you have so many different types of ecosystems and actually what we call mega-diversity countries, some of the most biodiverse places.
And there are just these artificial national boundaries within this large area. Are all of the countries involved dealing with it in pretty much the same way?
Well, most of the oil is in the Andean Amazon region. That's sort of the big oil boom right now. So that means the Amazon regions of Colombia, Peru, Ecuador, and to some extent Bolivia. So in those countries, yes, you have sort of a central government's role has been to promote oil exploration and exploitation at sort of without scrutiny, without sort of discrimination. Anywhere is fair game.
And why has the discovery of oil been so detrimental to the environment? Now you can extract oil in an environmentally sound way, can't you?
Well, it's interesting. We have not seen that happen yet anywhere in the Amazon. What we have seen is the last 30 years, about 30 years ago, was sort of the first strike for oil in northern Ecuadorian Amazon and also in northern Peru. And what we've seen in those situations is an old technology was used, technology that was outlawed in the United States since the 1919s and 1950s. Most states outlawed this technology where waste byproducts from the oil production were directly released into the environment. In Ecuador and Peru, companies just literally dumped into river systems and streams and left their open pits. There's, hundreds of open pits in this region, and they basically leak into the environment. They've caused massive environmental contamination. In fact, one remediation expert that looked at the current area contaminated by Chevron Texaco in northern Ecuador and Amazon, it's an area three times the size of Manhattan with over 650 waste pits. He called it the worst environmental disaster since Chernobyl. So it is incredible the extent of damage that's been done. Now they're trying to do it better, marginally better. They no longer dump directly into the environment. They do reinject. But once you open up the rainforest, You have a cycle of destruction that's accelerated. And that's what we're seeing everywhere. There's an oil pipeline. Everywhere there's an oil facility eventually becomes, lost in terms of biodiversity and forest cover.
And who's responsible? Is it the companies who are doing this irresponsibly, or is it the countries involved who should apply certain kinds of standards?
Well, they're both responsible. I think one can say that in Latin America, traditionally, the governments have not been very responsive to the citizenry. There's been a huge amount of violation of human rights. Many of these democracies are, though new democracies, are there's a lot of corruption. There's no judicial system. There's no justice system that works for the people. You have most of the communities that are affected are indigenous, and they're mostly marginalized communities that have been, traditionally discriminated against. So you don't really have a justice system that serves their needs. You have corporations who are cutting costs and trying to do business in what they think is remote areas where no one's watching.
But you also said that they have changed their policies. Is that because pressure was applied?
Sure. Certainly there's been, we saw what happened with Chevron Texaco in Ecuador and with Occidental Petroleum in Peru. After that, aftermath of that has been that there have been greater laws in place in these countries to prevent widespread damage. But again, as I said, there's oil spills every day that are not cleaned up. They're sort of, in some ways, they're operating in places maybe they shouldn't be. We have to step back and say, should they be in the headwaters of the Amazon region? Should they be drilling in areas where there are uncontacted tribes or tribes that solely depend on the water resources? Here we have potable water. We have plumbing into our houses. We have drinking water. In the Amazon, basically, you have thousands, tens of thousands of people who rely strictly on river water and local water systems that become very much affected by oil pollution.
We're talking about the environmental impact of drilling for oil in the Amazon. There is a legal suit against Chevron Texaco in Ecuador, isn't there? What does that involve?
Well, some 30,000 people have been affected by the drilling practices of Chevron Texaco. As I said, there's an area three times the size of Manhattan that's contaminated.
So how does that compare to the Exxon Valdez dumping?
It's several times. It's two to three times the size of the Exxon Valdez spill. But it didn't happen overnight. It happened gradually over time. And now the 30,000 people, including five indigenous tribes that live in this region, in order to live every day, they're drinking and bathing and living, growing their food in this contaminated water. So this there's been a lawsuit filed that's actually been going on for 11 years. I actually was mentioning to Kevin, my colleague, when we were walking by here, that it's been 11 years, and it was actually filed around the corner here in New York. And it's a very exciting case to watch. It's now in Ecuador. It's been sent back from the U.S. to Ecuador, where the trial is ongoing right now.
Well, Texaco merged with Chevron in 2001. Has that complicated this case?
Initially, there was an effort for Chevron Texaco to say they're not liable. But in fact, to say that this is a liability of a subsidiary of Texaco in Ecuador, therefore they're not liable. But in fact, Texaco also argued that this case should be sent back to Ecuador, where it could be more of a valid trial. And when the case was sent back to Ecuador, the court here in New York ruled that Chevron Texaco, the parent company, had to stand trial. Not a subsidiary, not Texaco, not TexPet, the original subsidiary, but Chevron Texaco, the parent company, had to stand trial. And I think that's a huge deal.
Now, Kevin, you started following this case 11 years ago. Why is it taking so long?
Well, it has a lot to do with the fact that Chevron Texaco has really tried to sort of shirk its responsibility. They argued for 10 years, right around the corner, that this case should be sent back to Ecuador because that's where the alleged damage was done. Now that that case is going forward in Ecuador, Chevron Texaco has started to argue and file it before an arbitration committee, which essentially, so we've seen Chevron Texaco try to sort of end run the whole legal process and not want to be held responsible in any courtroom.
But I would think that Ecuador would be concerned because of the environmental and health problems that it has created. I understand that cancer rates amongst infants has grown considerably. Now, I know that Ecuador has had hasn't always had the best record protecting its citizens, but government is there to do something, isn't it? Where do you think this case would be better served, in Ecuador or the United States?
You know, I think it either one. The fact is that these people they need something to come of this case. As Atosa was saying, these are people that their daily livelihood is they need the fresh water, they need fish to eat. They don't have any of those things right now, and I think if there needs to be remedy in either one of those places.
Well, what's exciting about this case is that although it is right now happening in Ecuador, when the New York court sent it back to Ecuador, the parties agreed that whatever judgment came out of the case would be it is actually enforceable in U.S. courts. So in a way, we do have the New York court sort of standing behind the trial process in Ecuador, giving it a lot of validity.
Since this has taken place partly in New York, why do you think there's been so little press coverage of it? I mean, we think about the Amazon. Often we get press coverage of the disasters that the gold miners have brought to the Amazon. Why not this?
I think it's changing. I think originally it was just seen as, occasional press coverage when the trial was happening. But we've seen sort of in the last year, we've seen a growing coverage of it. And I think that we definitely need to do more to educate the citizenry about this issue and issues like it. Because, for so long, places like the Amazon were sort of out of sight, out of mind. And now more and more, it's hard to ignore the images and the stories that are coming out. It was actually on the front page of the New York Times on a couple of times in the last year. So I think, it's gradually changing. Certainly we think it needs more coverage.
We're talking with Atosa Soltani, the founder and executive director of Amazon Watch, and Kevin Koenig, who is Northern Amazon Program Coordinator for Amazon Watch. We're talking about the results of oil exploration in the Amazon Basin. We will continue our conversation right after this. Stay with us for this underreported segment. I'm Leonard Lopate. This is WNYC 93.9 AM 820. We're online at WNYC.org. And my guests for this underreported segment are Atosa Soltani, the founder and executive director of Amazon Watch, and Kevin Koenig, Northern Amazon Region Coordinator for that organization. We've been dealing with this issue for a long time now, at least in the world courts. The Stockholm Declaration was signed in 1972, wasn't it? That identified the human right to a clean and healthy environment as a fundamental human right. Why hasn't it been invoked in this case, Kevin?
Even Ecuador itself, at the time when Texaco was operating, had a very similar wording in their constitution. And, unfortunately, Texaco, the reason the lawsuit was filed here in New York was because that was Texaco's headquarters, and that's where a decision was made to use this antiquated technology that instead of reinjecting the heavy metals, the carcinogens, the toxics back into the ground, which is standard industry practice, they dumped it out in the environment.
And how much does it save them?
The estimates are about $3 a barrel.
Mm-hmm.
So
that's
over
a lot of money.
Over 20 years, that's a significant amount of money.
Mm. Well, we've heard about indigenous people being angry at the fact that they weren't getting a cut of the sales of natural gas in Bolivia. There were major protests. Are the people in these other areas, in Peru, in Brazil, in Ecuador, Colombia, where this oil exploration is taking place, also concerned about that? Have they said, well, gee, this is on our land, we should get some kind of a royalty?
I think there's really several categories what we've seen in the Amazon. There, on the one hand, there are indigenous communities who are basically suffered the impacts and suffered the consequences. At this point, many of them aren't even asking for royalties. They're asking for reparation. They're asking for their drinking water to be restored. They're asking for medical clinics because of skyrocketing cancer rates. They're asking for really justice to be served and cleanup. There are other communities that are asking for royalties when it is on their land. And I think that there's a third category of communities we've been working with who are very much seen the damage oil development brings and have chosen a different vision for their development. They have a vision. It's not like they're opposed to development. It's just that they have a different vision of sustainable, ecologically benign development that respects their culture, their rivers, their forests, their religion. And I think they've just said, no, we don't want to negotiate with the oil companies. We don't want royalties. We don't even want you in here.
But even before oil was explored for in the region, other things like gold mining have caused major devastation, social ills, prostitution, violent crime. AIDS is now a serious problem in this area, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think that in every corner of the Amazon where there's been a large-scale industrial extraction of resources, we've seen grown, a sort of a social disintegration process and the destabilization of the region. We've seen in areas where there is, new pipelines built, well, 1,000, 2,000 workers at a time come into a remote rainforest to build a pipeline. Some of them end up engaging in illicit activities. There is prostitution. There's a cultural there's an invasion and a cultural degradation that happens when new areas where these communities have lived traditionally get opened up to that. So we've seen, they call it oil development, and I really differ with that definition. It's not development. And a lot of indigenous people say this isn't development, this is exploitation. So we've sort of called it, oil exploitation, not development, because we've not seen positive benefits. And I think that, gold mining has been in one big, in pockets, there have been gold deposits. In this case of oil exploration activities, which is the first step in oil exploitation, opens up frontier forests, places that, white man may not have been before. Right now in the Peruvian Amazon, there's oil exploration happening in territories where there's still isolated and uncontacted indigenous populations who have no immunity to outside diseases. So we're seeing the process that happened 500 years ago continue today.
So their rights to their own land have not been respected at all?
They've pretty much across the Amazon, you have a situation where the indigenous people have legal land title, from essentially from the soil up, and it's the governments that maintain the rights to the subsurface minerals. So, across the board, you have the governments that are auctioning off these oil blocks to companies without having had any sort of, consent from the local people.
Is there any way for industrial development and indigenous rights to coexist? I realize that this oil has been extracted in the worst way possible, but even if it were done in the best way possible, would it be having an impact on the land, putting oil into the soil?
I think that it's an interesting question. Can oil development be done, or oil exploitation be done in less harmful ways?
Because it still gets into the water systems, doesn't it?
I mean, in places like the Amazon, everything corrodes. In 20 years, every pipe corrodes, every pipeline leaks, every area, unless there's a total commitment to the environment first. But unfortunately, in 15 or 20 years, most of these companies get what they can and they run. They turn over aging, leaking infrastructure back to the central government to manage, and there is no money to keep them up. What we see is just it's basically inevitable disasters at every turn. It's an interesting question because I also dialogue with companies about this. They always ask me, isn't there a way we can do it better? I think the first question is, where are you trying to go? If it's an area that's already degraded where you can do better, yes, it's probably okay. But in a lot of cases, in new areas where it's a frontier forest, every time every pipeline is a road, and every road into a pristine, fragile rainforest is in its inevitable accelerated deforestation. And I think the other thing we're saying is that indigenous people's rights have to be, they have to be consulted, and there has to be consent.
Well, the effects of the Exxon Valdez spill are still being felt in Alaska. You say this is three times as vast. Would it even be possible to clean this mess up?
It would take decades.
How long before you could just have drinkable water?
In the Ecuador case, I don't think that there will actually be, that it's feasible to totally clean, you know, to get those places, the marshlands, the wetlands, the river systems, to be clean enough for and healthy enough for people to drink. And that's what the local, the demands of the local people are, is to actually, get the company to provide some potable water system.
My guests are Kevin Koenig and Atossa Sultani of Amazon Watch. This is WNYC 93.9 AM 820. We're online at WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Well, back in the 1970s, wasn't oil seen as an economic savior for Ecuador? What happened?
Yeah, for a long time, there's been this notion that oil is the panacea that's going to bring these countries, up and into become developed, in like the United States. And unfortunately, across the board, that has not been true. If you look at, again, Ecuador is a great example where, their external debt in the 1970s was about $200 million. Now, after the oil boom, it's about $16 billion.
And why would that be? Oil must have brought in some money to the economy.
It brought in some money. However, because there was, particularly in the case of Ecuador or, Venezuela, Peru, there was a massive amount of corruption that was happening. But as well, you also have a system now where, whether it's the IMF or the World Bank, that these countries have gotten trapped in this sort of downward spiral of debt and dependency, where the financial institutions are pushing them to continue to extract oil, and it's further impoverishing them because so much money is going directly to their external debt or to the companies themselves.
Is it also widening the gap between rich and poor, as we've seen in some other countries?
Well, there was a protest a couple of years ago in the oil-producing region of Ecuador, where production was basically halted for 2 to 3 weeks. And during that time, the communities that were protesting, including mayors and people of local towns, were pointing to the squalid conditions that the people themselves who live in the oil-producing regions have. Here's an area that's provided $60 billion over the last 30 years in terms of revenues, oil revenues, and yet the people who live in this region live in a state of poverty, their roads are unpaved, there's no potable water, there's only contamination. So, it questions what kind of development happened. Where did all that money go? $60 billion, even if a portion of it went to the government, the rest to the companies, what was the money used for? Even the IMF agrees that Ecuador squandered its revenues around oil due to corruption, being one of the most corrupt countries in the Western Hemisphere. A lot of that money went to provide to people's pockets. But oil made Ecuador creditworthy. So it made it allowed Ecuador to borrow billions of dollars against future oil revenues, and that's what's happening. In fact, most of the Amazon is seen as future oil revenues to help Ecuador keep down its debt, and that's what we're dealing with.
But Ecuador's oil reserves will run out fairly soon, you say.
Exactly, and that's
so won't be able
to
pay off that debt. We're talking about countries that not only are corrupt but are often unstable. Has oil exacerbated the instability?
Absolutely. I think there's a number of studies that have been done looking at the sort of what's known as the resource curse, looking at places like Venezuela, even Nigeria, Algeria, and South America. And, Ecuador has had six presidents in the last 7 years. And that's true. You see this sort of the part of the resource curse is, widening gap between rich and poor, inflated external debt, corruption, and political instability. And if you look at all these places that are are their major export is very resource extractive heavy. You're going to find those problems everywhere.
And also, along the same lines, Ecuador. The other instability that happens are in places like Colombia. We've seen in places where they're the resource curse is you've seen sort of militarization and sort of erosion of human rights, but you're also seeing an erosion of governance. I was just thinking back to the report that the World Bank internal process called the Extractive Industries Review, a process where the World Bank looked at its lending to extractive industries. And its own report looked at Ecuador as one of the case studies and said, their support, the bank's support of resource extraction in Ecuador had led to increasing corruption and poor governance. A government who was not capable of investing the resources from oil.
Well, Colombia still has large reserves, larger than most of these other countries, but it's a country that's had its own problems because of drugs and right-wing and left-wing insurrections. So is it likely that Colombia will handle this any better, watching Ecuador as a model for what not to do?
Unfortunately, the path that Colombia is on at the moment is disturbing, and that's particularly the majority of oil reserves in Colombia are untapped and unexplored because of the civil conflict. However, because of programs that we're now seeing, the Plan Colombia, which is happening, which is basically the training and of Colombian soldiers to protect oil infrastructure, and we're seeing that oil is actually in the places that extraction is happening. It's funding all sides of the civil conflict. You have paramilitaries that are illegally tapping the pipelines. You have oil companies paying off, whether it's the left-wing guerrillas, the right-wing paramilitaries, or the military. It's a vicious cycle, and everyone's getting richer, and it's the local people, indigenous campesino, that are getting caught in the crossfire.
You could say that oil, in Colombia, what you've seen is that oil revenues have fueled increasing violence. And that's really interesting, because we also are looking at right now the fact that our Congress, our tax dollars through the U.S. Congress, is going directly to pay for a quarter of the Colombian military to train them to protect oil infrastructure. So, in fact, now you have this extension of this foreign policy where we are seeing Colombia as a need to secure oil reserves for the United States, and so we are supporting the protection of oil infrastructure with our tax dollars. In fact, I think we've calculated what that is, and it's about $3.50 a barrel that we are paying, tax dollars in the United States are paying to subsidize security costs for Occidental Petroleum in Colombia.
What about Peru, which has experienced its own problems, a civil war? There's a thing called the Camisea Project there, which is kind of controversial. What is that all about?
It's a massive $3 billion natural gas project that would extract oil and get natural gas and liquid petroleum from the heart of the Peruvian Amazon, pipe the natural gas and liquids to the coast, and then use about a quarter of it for Peruvian's own consumption, and then the rest would be exported to mostly United States and Mexico. In fact, they're targeting markets in California. They're talking about taking that gas, freezing it, putting it in tankers, shipping it in these huge tankers in liquid form to places like Baja California and the coast of Los Angeles for use in California markets. And I think that it's a project that is brought already. This river valley is home to over 10,000 people, indigenous peoples whose primary source of life has been the rivers. Just Amazon Watch has been there the last 3 years. We've watched the construction of this project and seen what has happened. We've seen a total collapse of the local fishing resources. We've seen massive erosion of hillsides and destruction of streams upon which people depended on. And we've also seen one of the isolated tribes that lives in the reserve. And by the way, this project's financed by tax dollars, but through the Inter-American Development Bank, which is 30% U.S. Treasury money. And we've seen sort of the isolated communities there suffer. One health study that came out in December said that as many as 75 to 85% of this tribe are sick. And these are in remote areas where there's no medicine, no doctors. We're seeing if complete, you know, their future is at stake. And this is the Commissariat project that's supposed to bring economic benefits for the government, but it is actually not so.
Well, it's obvious that wherever oil and gas are discovered, you mentioned Algeria, Nigeria, we could also say Russia right now is going through serious problems, and of course the Amazon basin, that it always brings problems. And I wish you had you'd brought a happier story, but it's something that we should pay a lot of attention to, and I want to thank you both so much for being with us. Atossa Soltani, founder and executive director of Amazon Watch, and Kevin Koenig, who is the Northern Amazon Program coordinator for Amazon Watch. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks very much.